from NowVeryBad.com. A special bonus episode of Now Very Beast, Iron Maiden, the next 10 years.
Sunjutsu.
We'll do it for full politically incorrect points.
I mean, did they have, I haven't looked in the lyrics. Did they even use the word?
A few things I'll say about the album as a whole. It's easy to tell which songs I'm going to like more, even if you don't listen to the vocals and the guitar. Tell me what Nico's doing. If Nico's breaking a sweat, I'm interested. If he's keeping time, I'm asleep.
He's breaking a sweat a lot on this album, I thought. I thought that, you know, that Bruce and Adrian both, and I think even Yannick was, we're specifically calling out, like, wow, I think this is the best drumming he's done in years.
And I think that it's no coincidence that, you know, I would say my simple indicator is how interesting is what he's doing. Because he is a spectacular drummer when he brings his A game. A lot of people sleep on him. He arrives, especially these days where it's about, you know, sounding like a helicopter landing through a distortion pedal in the state of modern metal. But he definitely makes a statement to open this album. Inarguable, in my opinion, if they ever tour in support of this record, that they would open with this. I can even hear the cues where Bruce is going to be yelling out to the crowd. Like, it's a first, you know, it's a first spot in an album song. It's an open the set song. It's got a different flavor. I actually wish there was more of this in the album, because this is one of a couple songs, and especially this song, that actually could have been on a Dickinson solo record. It has some of that. Something different is happening here, which is great. So
it's interesting then that Dickinson doesn't have a credit on it.
Yeah.
And also interesting that we're talking about Nico's drumming on this, because the drumming on this was actually arranged by Adrian.
Adrian wrote this tune on those Dickinson albums is maybe the link then. Right. He's on this song, if I remember right.
Yeah, no, this is an Adrian tune. Yeah. It's commented when I did the, you know, the live reaction to this thing before, I was mentioning to my daughter that, you know, when you see Steve Harris's name tacked on to any song, you have to take that with an enormous grain of salt.
Right.
Maybe he was hugely involved. Maybe he just wanted to be part of it.
Right.
You can't really be sure. So I always, you know, when I see a Smith Harris song, I'm like, oh, this is an Adrian song.
Right.
I'm not saying Harris didn't have anything to do with it. He probably did. But Smith came up with the tune. And I know that he talked about that he did this on Pro Tools. And he came up with the drum thing, and then Nico essentially redid it.
Oh, I did not know that.
So I believe it was that or Days of Future Past, but I'm fairly certain it was this one because the drums are so interesting on this. And it's not the first time. The beginning of Final Frontier, the opening Satellite 15,
that sounds like a Pro Tools thing.
Well, yeah. That is. Yeah, that is not actually Nico playing. That is Drum Machine, something that Adrian put together on there. It opens really strong. I can't entirely support an 8-minute opening song.
No, it could have been over at 5 minutes, and then everything that happens after was the intro to a different song. It wasn't better for its length, but the first half is very good.
Yeah, I mean it's definitely a highlight. It's a highlight on the record for me, and I have to resist the urge when putting this on as we record this. The album's been out for 4 days or something, and I mean it just came out. But I have to keep stopping myself from just putting the record on from beginning, because I like the opening track so much, and then because there's no point in re-listening to the singles, which I've heard so much, I want to hear the tunes I haven't heard.
Right.
But it's hard, because I really think that those first three songs are the strongest part of the whole record.
It's the most consistent.
It's kind of hard to argue with that, and Maiden historically starts their albums really strong.
Yep.
They are absolute believers, and you put your best stuff up front. There's no point in waiting until the second side of your demo to get a good song.
And they usually end strong. I can't say always, but they almost always put a strong song at the end. And I think that holds on this too.
So Senjutsu, if they ever get around to doing a Senjutsu tour, that will absolutely 100% be their opening track. It'll be good for an opening track. It'll be better if they remember that they don't have to play the whole damn thing.
Right. Fade out early, gentlemen.
But they don't. They don't fade out.
Oh, no, I know.
And this is actually, we'll get to it, but Hell on Earth is only the fourth time in their entire discography, their entire catalog,
that they've done a fade.
That they have done a fade out. And when I was doing the live reaction thing, and I was actually like, oh my God, I think they're fading out. This is a big deal. I was trying to remember what the other one was, because I remember there was Women in Uniform, the terrible cover, fades out. And that The Prophecy, the best song on Seventh Son of Seventh Son, Fight Me, The Prophecy fades out.
Wow, we need a different episode for that.
I couldn't remember the third one off the top of my head. And of course, it was Stranger in a Strange Land.
Ah, I'm thinking now, playing in the collection in my head.
And that's it. Those are the three songs. And even now, I've listened to Hell on Earth several times, and I'm still not 100% sure that it's a classic fade out. Mm. It's fading out.
Yeah.
But I don't want to blow out my speakers. I keep turning the thing up because, as far as I can tell, it stops making sound at about 11 minutes in, and there's a good 10 seconds or something left on the song where I don't hear anything. Mm-hmm. And I keep turning it up to see.
Oh, I thought there might be a surprise track. Like, I literally, the first time I listened, thought there might be like, thanks for making it all the way to the end, guys. Or like, for the first time, Maiden would have a Monty Python moment and like do something unexpected. Because I'm like, what? Because it's fading when there's like a minute and something left. It's a very gentle
fade. It's the longest fade out I think I've ever heard.
I've listened to this album, other than the singles, I've only listened to this album on headphones. And that's much more apparent on headphones. And I don't mean AirPods. I mean like over the year, good headphones. Not that AirPods suck. But they're not critical listening equipment. They're very convenient.
They're convenient equipment,
And on real headphones, you hear that so much more clearly. So there are some things that I'll say about my review that probably annoy me more, that are less annoying if you're listening on speakers or in a car. And so I'll get my one annoyance out of the way, which is the synthesizer that, you know, is uniquely pinned to being needlessly high in the range at whatever it is, 8 hertz or whatever, that it's doing like 2 octaves higher than what Steve is doing in most but not all of the songs, thank God. And it sticks out like a sore thumb because it's like a late 80s synth sound. They have one preset that they use in all of the songs. And I'm like, guys, you know, it's a synth. It's not a real string section. You could have afforded a real string section. You're using a synth string sound sample, and you're using the same one in all the songs. And it's a little piercing in all of them. So,
which is particularly interesting because it's coming after they've done it better.
Yes.
Now, famously, Maiden, you know, didn't use synth up until their 7th studio album.
Mm-hmm.
On the 6th studio album, they used guitar synth, which I still don't totally understand how that works. And apparently it didn't work all that reliably, which is, at least in a live setting, which is, I've always been stunned that they didn't continue with that sound at all. And it's my understanding, and you being more of a guitar nut will know and can answer this for me, like, why didn't they do it again?
Yeah, it was, Adrian, because it's very much an Adrian thing.
Yes.
Adrian was very early to that technology. He could afford it. That technology at that point was very finicky. So to get the guitar strings to appropriately translate to non-magnetic pickups, because traditional guitar pickups are magnetic, and to translate differently to different pickups, and to be consistent night after night after night on a tour was really hard.
Right.
Because if any little fine adjustment, which if you're putting a guitar in a plane and then a truck and the heat and distance, it was a physical mechanistic thing. Mm-hmm. And so that one night it would sound the way he wanted, the next night one string would sound wrong or wouldn't pick up at all. And then the pieces were rare, the pieces were expensive. Not that the money was an issue at that point in their tour, but
practicality.
It was not a very practical thing to do. And I think that's part of why they said, you know what would work better? Well, let's just have a synth player backstage or on stage in a costume. Or, you know, they did different things in different tours.
Right.
And I think that's part of why they did it, because it was a constant source of stress versus just having a synth that's built to be a synth. Now, if they were to do it today, it's trivial to do it today. You can do it with an off-the-rack guitar. Boss now even makes a synth guitar.
Which is why I don't understand why they haven't come back to it. I mean, what you're saying more or less squares with what I had heard a bit of and assumed mostly, which was that it wasn't practical live, so they moved away from it. And there's a whole nother discussion to be had about, don't you guys realize that what you do on the record doesn't have to be the same thing you do live, which mm-hmm. is something they've never made peace with and I've never understood.
Yep.
And it's one of the sources of the greatest consternation for me with this band, is that what they do live is the same as what they do in the record. Mm-hmm. And particularly, I think about that all the time, never so much as I did on Friday listening to this record for the first time, saying, if you want to play this song for 12 minutes, that's fine, yeah. live.
Yeah.
But there's no reason you need to do it in the studio. And I don't understand why they've never understood that bands throughout time have vamped
yeah.
and jammed and taken tunes that were 3 minutes on their record and yeah. turned them into 6 minute songs.
Right.
And that if you want to play a song for 10 minutes when you do it live, that's fine. But that does not obligate you
right.
to play all 10 minutes on the record. No one's going to feel like you're breaking any kind of rules. So I thought that it would just make sense to continue with the guitar synth somewhat, particularly in view of having, once they had a third guitar player, because we know that Adrian changed his style. You know, when he came back, he was very clear and very upfront. He said, you know, Yannick is the guitar player, you know, he's going to be playing or whatever. He's the guy who came in here. He's not going to change what he's been playing as my replacement, essentially. Mm-hmm. I'm the one who's going to need to change.
That hasn't held iron true, though. It isn't like they're playing Wasted Years with Yannick playing the melody.
Yeah, they've definitely made,
though they double it.
We're gonna have a Yannick show.
Though the other thing I'll say is, remember, because the chronology, real quick, of Somewhere in Time, which is by far the most Adrian album that will ever be. I mean, if Adrian made an album, it would be Somewhere in Time. And I've always wondered if, you know, like Beth pissed off Paul Stanley, that, you know, that the song that is more Adrian than anyone else, that Steve was initially against because he thought it was too poppy, was their biggest hit up till then. And that, you know, only one album later, the writer of that song leave because he's sick of putting up with Steve. You know, is he going to make a big stink about doing a lot of synth? You know, no, we'll just have a synth player do it. And then he leaves. And then when he comes back, now the spectrum is so crowded, you've got another guitar player, you know.
Right.
But that's why, I guess
that's what I'm getting at, is that's why it's needed now. Because...
But Brave New World has very little synth on it.
But Dance of Death is silly with synth.
It's an interesting contrast.
Yeah. It's all over the place. And that was a lot of the criticism of that album, is enough to the point where the singles for the tunes off of Dance of Death, a lot of them have different mixes of some of those tunes, mm-hmm. where they call one a rock mix, mm-hmm. and they'll call another orchestral mix. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're not real orchestral strings, as you pointed out, but they are very similar sounding, much more so. So coming back to where we were talking about with the history of synth, when they introduced synth in Seventh Son, it was still the one finger, you know, playing on it, with the exception of something like the title track, Seventh Son, mm-hmm. where Michael Kenney really was playing some serious mm-hmm. keyboards there, and that was when they brought him out on stage dressed as
Phantom. And there is guitar synth on Moonchild. That intro is guitar synth.
No, it's both. It's apparently on Moonchild, he wrote it with a delay pedal, just guitar with delay, and then they doubled it on synth. And so
they blended them.
They blended it. So that's why it sounds that way. And he said he never actually was able to get it, the keyboards, exactly like he originally played it on guitar.
So, yeah.
And now when they play it live, it's funny because once they reintroduced that tune on the Somewhere Back in Time tour, he actually played it just as a guitar with a delay pedal. So it sounds actually, if you listen to Moonchild from that record, the 666, it sounds different.
Oh, no, no, no. And the trick for all of you listening at home, and why is it hard for me to play that? He's doing what many of you will associate with the Edge from U2. He's doing the dotted eighth, the same thing as like Flight of the Wounded Bumblebee, Nuno Bettencourt. Right. But he's doing it on a rhythm riff, you know, the
It's playing very little.
But the delay is what makes that sound so crazy. And asking the synth to do that and for them both to be in time live, yeah, good luck with that.
Right.
I mean, you might as well just have the computer do it because it's otherwise it's going to sound like a disaster sandwich. Yeah.
But where I was going with this was that the low water mark for Maiden and keyboards has to be The Angel and the Gambler off of Virtual 11. That is the single worst keyboard sound. I mean, you have to go back to, I mean, like Bobby Brown.
I think we could in fairness say that the low water mark was Virtual 11 and just end. We don't even have to say more. But, and that's not, that's not to pick on the singer. I actually think that album is more Harris's fault than anyone's.
Oh, it's certainly. But the funny thing is about The Angel and the Gambler is, as a 3-minute single, it's not a bad song. I actually kind of like it.
It's a great title. I was encouraged by
it. It's like
title.
An 8-minute track, and it's the longest, most drawn out song, even including these ones we're talking about here today. That still is the most repetitive song that's ever been. But that song has got uniquely awful keyboard sounds that even in the day, people are like, what on earth is it? The actual tone. It's not what they're playing.
Right. Did you find a Casio with the dump?
It really sounds like a Casio keyboard. So they did that. And then they did really fairly authentic orchestral strings on Dance of Death. And now here we are in 2019 when they're recording this.
Right.
And somehow they've ended up closer to Virtual 11.
Right.
Than Dance of Death when it comes to keyboard sound. And I just don't understand how we ended up there.
Right, yeah.
It's crazy.
I blame Shirley. That's his job. But I will say, you know, to give a little forgiveness to Blaze, when you listen to the latter three songs on this album, in particular the eighth and the ninth songs, you realize that what happened to Blaze has now happened to Bruce. And that Bruce has been forced into word salad lyrics that are just so on the beat, it's painful, that anyone could be made to sound like a doofus reading these words. Yeah.
Well, it's the tying of the lyrics to the melody.
Right.
And, you know, one of the things that once you learn a little bit about how the sausage is made, it's impossible to unsee it, right? That's true about a lot of stuff. And knowing that Harris composes by, you know, writing these tunes on the bass, not on a guitar, regardless what instrument's going to end up playing them, and is essentially will like whistle out a melody. Once you know that, it's really hard to not recognize that pattern in some of these songs and say, why on earth is the guitar doubling the vocal line? Why is the vocal line so incredibly on the beat every time? And why is he singing and saying those exact things?
I'm in a Volkswagen factory. This is very precise and I don't like it. Yeah.
And it has to be because of the way it's written.
Right.
That he's not going to sing something or whistle something that he can't do while he's playing.
Right.
So it, by necessity, is going to closely hew to what's being played. And that is getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. One of the things I really wanted to talk to you about with the guitar perspective on this, because there are three guitarists in Maiden now. And we know why, because Yannick is a stand-up guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's a really good guy. He, for whatever criticisms I've leveled at his playing, I will never criticize his team player attitude. He's absolutely kept the wheels on the bus, kept things going in here. And when they brought back Bruce and Adrian, there was no way they were going to sack Yannick, nor should they have, because
no one,
they would have been the wrong thing to do.
Right.
And it would have been a disaster. Well, it wouldn't have been a disaster, but we would have lost out on a lot of great songs because Gares is a great songwriter.
If Gares, and I've been a vocal critic of his leads in particular and his sometimes all too casual relationship to the beat. But I will say to cut to the chase, if Gares isn't in the band, we probably never got this record because the band would have been done several years ago.
Oh, easily. I think maybe 3 or 4 albums ago would not exist. We know why there are 3 guitarists in there, despite the fact that there's no call for it. There's absolutely no necessity, even in this band, for 3 guitarists. There's a lot of other bands that have 3 guitar players. There's no need for them either. But this band was kind of unique. When we all heard the news that they were reuniting, you know, the Bruce and Adrian were coming back, and they're like, but wait, the new guy's staying? We're going to have 3 guitarists? I think a lot of us got excited by the possibilities that were open up because Maiden had done so many guitar harmonies. Mm. Like, no band since Thin Lizzy had made as much use of these dual harmonies. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was going to be really excited to hear 3 guitar harmonies. Mm. Tell me if I'm wrong. It feels like they do fewer guitar harmonies now than when they were a 5-piece.
Well, I think there's actually a lot of 3-part, even 4-part guitar parts on this. I think, and that's one of the strengths of the album. So we've been real tough on this album so far. As I said, I think at the beginning, even in the songs I don't like, with a couple exceptions, there's parts that are fantastic. There's a lot of 2 people doing a harmony and 1 person playing a rhythm. So there's 3 guitar things happening, and it's the 3 of them. Like, Yannick, who's doing exactly what every song? I haven't parsed it that finely. But there's a lot of harmonies and then a rhythm, and they probably democratically split it up. And there's parts where there's even 3 harmonies and a rhythm in some songs. I think the issue is it's a little muddy. Like, the mix isn't bad, but it's not good in that sense at all times. And in the past, they were really strongly focused on a certain harmony. It was 2 guitars, and they were just slapping you in the face with it. Like, this is the harmony and a minor third and this. And it's inarguable. In this, they're like, oh, well, there's this string thing, and then there's this rhythm thing, and then Harris, and they're more, and this is where I say it's more like reggae than progressive. Like, the net of the pieces is what they were shooting for, but no one piece is as strong. And I think that's the struggle with this album. It's a little too much T-ball, to make a New England 70s, 80s joke. They want everyone's part to matter every song, which is the problem. Like, yeah. I think this album would have been better if they said, look, pick any one guitar player. This isn't your song, bud. This is a...
Sit it out.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
This is a Murray Gurr song. This is a Harris Murray song. Like, let it be that, and then you're just holding down a floor tile, buddy. But because they wanted everyone to be in most of the songs, and I think I can go out of order, that's part of why Darkest Hour works so well. That is not a 3-guitar song. And like, Yannick has a throwaway part in that song. Like,
well, I guess that's...
Not because it's Yannick, but because the song's not crowded as a result.
I mean, that's my question on this, is that I quite literally don't know what all 3 players are doing on some of these tunes, enough to the point where I'm not sure if they're all on it. And I think that they are, because it sounds so homogenized. It sounds like, not only does it sound like the 3 guitarists are playing the exact same thing, very frequently they're playing the exact same thing that Harris is playing. Mm-hmm. So you essentially just have this thick wall of more or less the exact same tone running right through the middle of these. And so if they are actually harmonizing the guitars, I'm not even sure I'm noticing it, because when you had 2 guitarists that would play together on a harmony, you know, minor third, root, harmony, there was then separation between them and the bass.
And they're also panned hard left and right.
So there was a big hole in the middle.
Right, which was everything else, yeah.
And you could identify it, and they might be playing the exact same thing now, but since you have a center channel of
that also has guitar,
rhythm guitar, and because Harris writes these songs, you know, he plays chords going up to Seventh Son. Mm-hmm. He strummed, you know, right, root, fifth, octave, power chords once or twice in a particular tune. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you could count them. Right. You know, it was done for emphasis. It stood out a lot in a couple tunes like Power Slave, but for the most part, it was, you know, the opening of Ace is High or something like that. You know, they were for emphasis. And then running through the 90s on, particularly from 2000 on, he started doing it all the time.
Right.
As a percussive instrument, as if he wasn't already enough of a ball hog, as if he wasn't already getting enough on these things, he started, and I think it was partly because when, you know, he'd write the tune, so he'd strum out a chord, but then when he goes to record it for the album, he still does that instead of just playing the root, which is what he ought to do. So there's just, I mean, this is another case of where it would really be addition by subtraction, because there's no headroom here. There's no sonic space. And so I'm left with the impression, again, I'm sure if we go track by track, album by album, find that I'm not right. But I'm like, I don't think I can name one instance of all three guitarists playing the same harmony and playing or harmonizing with each other. Mm-hmm. It's always at most two guys and a rhythm track. A rhythm track that is completely unnecessary because Harris is playing the rhythm track.
Right. Yeah, that's another.
I don't think that there's a single case where you have a single melody line where one guy's playing the root, one's playing a third, and one's playing a fifth. I don't think they've done it a single time.
I don't know. I would need to listen for that because there's a lot of guitars in some of these songs.
And that's what I expected when they announced that they were going to have three guitarists. I'm like, this is awesome. So, Thin Lizzy couldn't do that. They only had two guitars.
So here's
Maiden
a question.
Only had two guitars.
Here's a question for the band if they're listening, which they're surely not, or Kevin Shirley. Speaking of exactly this, so one of my favorite songs on the record is the last song because Maiden has a tradition of keeping a strong song for the end. And I think of the 10-minute plus songs, this is my favorite. But this song doesn't, you know, the late ending of this song, not the end, because I actually like the intro and the end on this one. It just, it works for me. But the part before the long fade out, they replay the guitar harmony that they were playing in the first two-thirds of the song, but they play it slower.
Right.
Which, frankly, sucks. And the thing about it that pisses me off is, one, it's like the de-energized version. It's the decaf version. But they're suddenly not playing it together. Like, they're a little bit, they're playing it slower. And I don't know if you noticed this.
I did. It seems like it's almost out of time. Like, that they come from a transition into this bit where they are going to be at a different tempo,
right,
but then it changes again.
Yeah, Bruce
and
does
it sounds
little
unintentional.
Right, but the thing that I notice is, and they're not a sloppy band. So was this a decision? Did they say, you know what, we're not going to line up on this. You're going to be a little bit late. I'm going to be a little bit early, because they're out of sync with each other, and it gives it this weird warbly feeling that like makes me minorly seasick. Now, given that the song is called Hell on Earth, maybe that was by design, because they're not stupid.
I don't believe it, and I think the reason that I don't believe it is because, and this was one of the thoughts I had driving here today, because I was giving this song a lot of thought, too, because I do agree that it's the strongest of the two goddamn long songs on here, which is faint praise, to be terribly honest.
Oh, yeah, no,
but
I legit
think, I think that it's the best one on there. But I was listening to this, and I hit pause around minute 8, I think it was. I wasn't taking notes. I was driving. Mm-hmm. Because I actually, on my first listen to this, I had commented, I said, wow, this song ended a lot better than it began.
Mm-hmm.
But really, I think what it is that somewhere, and I'm not going to have the times right here, but I think it was around minute 6, somewhere in there that it took a left turn.
It does. You
know, the song changes, but I'm saying, like, I'm not sure exactly where it happened, but it was around that point.
Nico does a four count.
It does a big change.
Yeah, so they won't drive into a wall because the song slows way down.
And then it becomes essentially a different song.
Right. Bruce does some little beat poetry rap thing.
Which is
terrible.
Well, yeah. Whether it's good or bad, it is what it is, right? Yeah. And then it shifts again.
Well, then he does the Lost in Anger, Life in Danger thing, which I actually like. And if they just skipped the slowdown part and went from where they changed for no benefit to the poetry to just that, I'm going to make a fan edit of that. I think it would be better.
So I made a vocal note here. I was hitting the voice recorder on my phone. And I said, okay, here's the thing about that. This tune, I hit pause at about 8 minutes in to this 11-minute song. And I said, I'm really enjoying what I'm listening to right now. Like this part here, I really like. And I now would challenge anybody who's enjoying this song right now to sing for me the first riff of this tune,
mm-hmm.
or the first verse of this tune.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody could do it because it's not the same song. It really sort of gets into, like, I don't, and this is my answer to, were they sloppy, were this not that? I think that this was put together like a jigsaw puzzle.
It feels like it.
Yeah. I know that with some of these tunes, I know that it was not recorded in one stretch. Oh, some of it was, but with some of these tunes, because they've said that about certain tunes like Alexander the Great in the past. So like we couldn't even record that all in one thing. You did it in like little chunks or whatever. And I think that has to be the case here because listening to it, I don't know how you could possibly square, if you were playing this in real time, if you were trying to play the song from beginning to end, I don't know how you could possibly square these parts and say this. I don't know how you would, honest to goodness, remember what song you were playing. And I think that that's my entire
concept
with the album in one nutshell, is that I feel like these longer tracks were pieced together. And if your song is so long that you have to piece it together, then it's too long.
Or it's two songs. That's part of why they're so dependent on these, at times, frivolous bookends, you know, which this song definitely has. I actually like this bookend. This, to me, is the most successful of the three. The bass line that they also do in guitar. This one is my favorite of the three. But that it shows up at the end is like, oh, wait, it's that song? Because you've so left anything that had set up for you. And I think the first 6 minutes of this song are really strong. And I think the second 4 minutes are not as strong. And again, a couple boos, because this song is beautifully queued up for an epic solo. And then Yannick just wanks away a few mediocre bends. And it's like, dude, you were so set up for this. And to his credit, on a couple other songs, he does surprisingly good work on the first half of this album. So I wasn't sure he was going to waste the opportunity like he did, which is, I think, the other sign that this song is off the rails. Because they've had so many chances to solo for as long as they want on this record, that literally by the end, Yannick was out of ideas. He's like, dude, I've given you everything I have. I don't.
Well, if they recorded it in sequence. Yeah.
I just feel like he was literally done.
But there's a lot of first takes, too, that Maiden has made this classic mistake. And I know we're sort of in a trend and a little negative on
We need to now talk about
review here. But I think that would be the last sort of really negative sort of thing I would say on here, is that if you are feeling like you need to plan things out less and do more impromptu things, then you should go back to the album where you decided that was the way to go. Mm-hmm. It was called No Prayer for the Dying, and it's almost universally reviled, even though I have a soft spot for it for reasons I've gone into on the show before about going and getting it with John. But taking a step back from the calculated, well-thought-out planning of Seventh Son and going to be just a rocky, punky, back-to-basics band was one of the worst decisions in the history of bad decisions. And anything that smells of that, like taking an accomplished songwriter like Adrian Smith, who thoughtfully plans out solos, and having him in a position where he feels either that he should or wants to, or feels like he is, needs to be doing things off the cuff, is an equally horrible, horrible decision. And if you don't know what you're going to play on a solo, then I would suggest that maybe you don't need to have a solo on every damn tune.
Agree. Especially T-ball, everyone gets a turn. I think that's the mistake. It's not that I mind a solo on every song. This is Iron Maiden, Guitar Kings we're talking about.
Right.
But everyone gets a solo, creates the wrong mindset, and you're just killing time. So to go to the flip side of that, let's now go to, since we're brutally out of order anyway,
right,
what I think is structurally, and you know, if I could say what's the one song on this album I'd play for someone who's never heard Iron Maiden before, is only one answer for me. Easy answer. Mike knows what this answer is. Yeah, it's Darkest Hour. Because it's that, and I didn't know this when I heard it initially, but by the time I heard the lyrics and then heard everything else, I knew that this was a Dickinson-Harris number, because Sons of Albion is a line that only Dickinson writes.
No, Smith, Dickinson.
Yeah. Oh, no, I know. But Sons of Albion is a Dickinson line.
Oh, yeah.
The guy has a fetish for describing England in as many different adjectives as possible.
Yes, he does.
He has sent me to the thesaurus and the dictionary enough times that I knew what that one was, you know, to getting into good Arthurian legend and other things. And you hear the song itself, you know Adrian wrote it. And that's just peanut butter and jelly. That's a formula that has delivered like the mail, the U.S. mail, as Elvis would say, you better not mess with the U.S. mail, son. And that's a good double entendre from Elvis.
Oh, my goodness.
Because I worked Elvis in, so I'm proud of myself. But no, this song structurally has, in my opinion, it has no fat that so many of the other songs do. It's memorable. It's catchy. I'll give it another compliment. I could see this song on several other albums much earlier in their career. It wouldn't have stuck out as weak or strange or in any way other than solid. I think the other thing that's interesting is they do some different things with this song, given that they've done so many slow songs and that's such a staple thing for them. And it's divisive among some fans, as Mike has noted. I have a soft spot for their slow songs. I think it's been one of the ways they've been most consistent. If I look at the reunion era albums, I like the slow song on almost every reunion album era a lot. And this one's no different, because I think they just have it. They have it sorted. They don't go to that well too often. When they do go, there's good emotional delivery there from Bruce. The band does what they don't do on some of the other songs. This doesn't sound like there's six guitars fighting each other for space. You listen to this, it could be a two guitar Maiden song. And to his credit, Yannick doesn't take a solo on this song, but he does do the special effects outro stuff on the song. And I can say that because
the seagulls and all that stuff?
Well, the pan stuff and the noises. If you've just heard the song, you'll know what I mean. Because to me, it sounds like a long Adrian solo with a bit that's probably Dave. Then when the solo section and Dunn and Bruce is singing again, there's some fills and trills. That sounds like Yannick, because one of the things they did on this record that's interesting is they tried to give people slightly different guitar sounds. You know, one of the critiques.
Very slightly.
Yeah. But I hear it. Admittedly, I'm a guitar player. I have a fetish for these things. Yannick has a filtered wah sound on a lot of this album, not the rocking Jimi Hendrix wah, but I stepped on it and left it somewhere in the middle of the sweep.
The Jerry Cantrell sound.
Yeah, a little bit of the Jerry Cantrell sound. It's got a little of that honk and filter, and it's clearly his playing style. So I think that's another thing that really works on this song. To his credit, Yannick does some nice work on Stratego. I was pleasantly surprised by the first half of the solo Yannick lays down on Stratego. I was like, hey, look at that. Showing up. Did some homework.
Even a stopped clock is right twice a day.
You know, and there's a lesson for you guitar players listening out here about Yannick actually plays fast, but part of why he doesn't sound, you know, the way that I think everyone likes is because, unlike Dave and Adrian, you know, 99 times out of 100, they always keep their relationship to the beat, and not the obvious beat, but the cadence within the beat. And Yannick has a very different approach, not saying he's wrong.
He is wrong.
Within a section, he'll just play and he'll land in the right place. But he's not worried about where am I in relation to the beat until the end. And that's a style choice Some people love it, but...
And then the rest of us are right.
The rest of us are right. I agree. But when he does...
Yannick isn't worried about where he is in relationship to the neck, the stage, any of these things. Yannick is a sloppy... sloppy soloist.
It's true. But what's interesting is when, whether it was coincidence or by choice, when he does focus, he can deliver the goods. So it's not that he's not capable. So if you're listening,
he's Yannick, a fantastic writer. I have come 180 on Yannick. I had a quote that I found in one of those emails where I started, I think the subject line of this email to you guys was Yannick. Mm-hmm. And I said, Yannick should just come over and take a shit on my stereo. That's how little he thinks of it.
Okay, so...
Which was unbelievably harsh. However, I was talking about Yannick the soloist, not Yannick the songwriter. Yannick the songwriter is fantastic. He has written some excellent, excellent pieces. And then he solos on them and completely changes my opinion back to what it was. I don't know. Maybe he's just the Kim Thayil of this band.
You're here for one thing.
Kim Thayil is one of the greatest rhythm and riff guitarists of all time.
He comes
up with some of the greatest tunes, and he should never be let within 12 bars of a solo. It should just not occur.
Yeah. What makes him a liberated man who's unhindered by convention and delivering fresh sounding things? That's part of why I think, because I think it's two sides of the same coin. Love his rhythm playing because it's unconventional, but it works. But when we get to the, all right, now you've got a fixed amount of time and a prescribed format to deliver something, that's challenging for him.
And I don't understand why they feel the need to do it. Maybe he thinks that he is doing a good job. Maybe he likes the solos that he writes. I don't know.
That band also was...
He's earned them. I mean, I will sit through a song. It's not like I'm... sitting there going, oh, I can't believe they let me solo.
The advantage of being a Seattle band was there was no expectation there. And I remember the... in the studio.